Hello, my name is Chrissy Champagne. You're listening to Residue, a true crime podcast dedicated to keeping you paranoid. Today, we're going to be discussing a case that would forever change the way that we view talk show television, more so ambush television. If you remember back in the 1990s, we were just bombarded with daytime TV talk shows. And the way that these producers approached these shows, definitely not the right way to be doing it. This is the murder of Scott Amador, and you may have heard it referred to as the Jenny Jones murder. Daytime TV talk shows had this huge grip on me when I was younger, and I would just rush home from school and I would want to watch Oprah, Jenny Jones, Phil Donahue, Sally Jesse Raphael. I don't know, daytime talk shows and even now reality shows to me always feel like a palate cleanser. I mean, especially after I research crime and murder and like ghosts all day, I do have to watch something ridiculous before I go to bed, just something like House of Villains or Vanderpump Rules. But back then, back in the 90s, these shows were supposed to be just fun and chill, but they were not always fun and chill. The history of reality TV is so interesting to me, and it's not only just like a look into our psyche and why we consume this, but the whole production aspect of it, the off-camera, the casting, the writing, everything that goes into it when those people step out on stage has always intrigued me. And that's probably why I got a degree in television production and then proceeded to never use it. When the producers are casting, they have to be making specific choices, and they have to pick people who will fight and yell, people who will clash, people who will be scared and timid, others who might make the audience laugh or cry, and then they put them all in the same room together and they just cross their fingers for fireworks. And what if they don't get stellar TV? Well, you have to assume that they make that happen on their own. And that's what it's all about, right? With such a saturated market, you're gonna have to figure out a way to stand out. But how? And it's always at the expense of these real people's lives. Someone is gonna have to be the villain, someone is gonna have to be the hero, and we all wanna see a beautiful love story play out and happen like a fairy tale romance. And then we all want to see it fall apart and explode. Well, not we all. Not all of us want to see that happen, but you know what I mean. Okay, here is a list of some of the daytime talk show hosts that were around and had their own shows in the 1990s. So we have, obviously, Maury Povich, Phil Donahue, Oprah Winfrey, Montel Williams, Geraldo Rivera, Ricky Lake, Jane Whitney, Richard Bay, Carney Wilson, Sally Jesse Raphael, Rolanda Watts, Anderson Cooper, Jerry Springer, Dr. Phil McGraw, Queen Latifah, Jeremy Kyle, Lisa Gibbons, Gordon Elliott, Charles Perez, Tempest Bledsoe, and Jenny Jones. And out of all of those daytime television talk shows, the one that had the most impact on our society and the way that talk show TV was approached was obviously The Jenny Jones Show. The Jenny Jones Show appeared on the scene in 1991. The show premiered in September of 1991 on 178 television stations nationwide, which was actually the biggest launch in syndicated talk show history. It was produced by Telepictures and it was distributed by Warner Brothers Television. So the show ran from September 1991 to September 2003, and it was taped in Chicago at WMAQ TV Studios. It ran for 12 seasons, and it had to compete against the likes of Oprah, The Phil Donahue Show, Jenny, whose real name is actually Janina Maria Stronsky. She actually attended a taping of The Phil Donahue Show in preparation for her new show. She said that it was the closest I could come to a talk show lesson. Before she ever launched a talk show, Jenny was actually the first woman to win a stand-up comedian portion on Star Search. She went on from that to open for Engelbert Humperdinck and later toured under her own name with a tour she called Girls Night Out. It was a woman's only show. She's also a phenomenal drummer, by the way. And the show's theme songs were actually composed by Jenny, the Jenny Jones Show theme songs. So Warner Brothers Television Studios offers Jenny the chance to host her own daytime TV talk show. And this is after seeing her on an episode on 2020 about the Girls Night Out tour. When Jenny was offered this job or this opportunity to have her very own talk show, she said, "I've always considered myself a talk show junkie. All my car buttons are on talk radio stations. I've always wanted to do a talk show, but I just figured no one would let me have one." The studio wanted to duplicate the success of her comedy stand-up show, Girls Night Out, with the Jenny Jones Show, in which Jones would, what the studio said she would do was tell jokes, sing comic songs, and discuss casual topics, always leaving time for the crowd to air a few pet peeves. Jenny Jones herself actually said that she envisioned the show as part pajama party, part group therapy, and part Oprah. And with the show's premiere, Jones rejected the tabloid talk show label, stating that this show is not for people who are looking for the sensational tabloid stuff. We will do serious topics, but we will do them with a smile. So that is not going to last very long because you are up, like I said earlier, against some really tough competition and you're going to need to put on a show. So let me give you a couple examples. So season 1, episode 20 of The Jenny Jones Show, which aired on August 28th, 1992, the title of that show was Bridesmaids and Shoes. So this is what they're talking about on that show, shoes. The next few episodes, season 1 still, now this is season 1, episode 45, was called Big Bosomed Strippers, and that aired in October of 92. So just a couple of months later, we're already up to Big Bosomed Strippers now. We're going to now get into episode 46, which is going to be called Non-Stereotypical Lesbians and Gay Men. Episode 47 of season 1 was called Fathers of Strippers. Episode 48 of season 1 was called Naked Workers. It's a little bit of a stretch going from shoes, naked workers, so we can see the pattern now. She's starting to get a little bit tabloidy. Now we come to what is called Ambush TV. Ambush TV starts to become all of the rage. Ambush TV is a television format in which guests are deliberately tricked into embarrassing or upsetting confrontations. In its third and fourth season, The Jenny Jones Show needed to keep up with the Joneses. See, I made a little joke. And the topics start to range from one-night stand reunions, mothers make over their teen daughters, to secret crushes revealed. If you're going to be on a secret crush revealed show, you are not going to know who you are going there to see. So the producers want to keep you in the dark, and they want you completely unaware of what's about to happen to you when you get on that stage. So producers are going to do their best to keep the topic a secret so that when you do walk out onto the stage in front of a studio audience and, you know, all of TV Nation, they would have the shock value at its highest. In season 4, March 6th, 1995, The Jenny Jones Show would gather to tape the episode called Revealing Same-Sex Secret Crushes, and this was going to be aired in May of 1995. The show would feature six guests who were invited to meet a secret admirer, and although the show was titled Same-Sex Secret Admirers, the producers would not fully disclose that to each guest. Scott Amador was born January 26, 1963 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He had three brothers and one sister. His mother's name was Patricia, and she was a housewife, and his dad was named Frank, and he was a truck driver. Same as my dad, Frank, a truck driver. In 1968, the whole family moved to Waterford, Michigan. But soon after, Scott's parents would get divorced when he was around 7 years old. And after that divorce, the kids lived mostly with their dad. Scott ends up leaving high school early. He gets his GED and he joins the Army. He was stationed in Germany for a while, but was honorably discharged after 3 years. Scott's family says that while Scott was in the Army, he had come out to the family and told them that he was gay. The whole family was very accepting of Scott, and he had a lot of support. So after the Army, Scott works in the telecommunications field, and he leaves it after a little bit and then becomes a bartender. He worked in a gay nightclub in Michigan called Club Flamingo, and he was known to even take in some of his friends when they were suffering or struggling with HIV complications. Scott's brother said that the whole family was so accepting of Scott, and he was just so giving and would help anyone in need. He was also a self-proclaimed talk show junkie. Scott had a friend named Donna Riley, and Donna lived in the same apartment complex as Scott's brother. So Scott would go over there quite often, and one day he arrived to the apartment complex to visit Donna, and Donna was outside in the parking lot with her car. She had someone underneath her car trying to fix it, and Scott says that he was pretty fond of what he could see from that position of the gentleman under the car. And that gentleman was named Jonathan Schmitz, and he is helping Donna fix her car. Jonathan Schmitz was born July 18th, 1970, and he was 24 years old at the time of the incident. He worked at a local bar named Fox and Hounds, and Jonathan, Scott, and Donna all become fast friends, and they hung out all the time. Everyone said that the trio was always together. Even being together that much, Scott had a crush on Jonathan, but Jonathan claims that he had no idea. He never knew that Scott had a crush on him. Jonathan gets a call from a producer at the Jenny Jones Show, and this producer says that they have a guest, and this guest has a crush on Jonathan, and they want him to come on to the show so that his crush can be revealed. Jonathan did ask, is it a man or a woman? She said it could be either one. And he, at this point, is thinking that it's his ex-fiance because Jonathan was engaged and they called the engagement off. So he thought, maybe it's my ex-fiance. So he agrees to go on the show. He even called Donna and Scott and asked them, like, is this you guys? Did one of you call the Jenny Jones Show and say you have a crush on me? Obviously, both Donna and Scott say no. They all arrive in Chicago on different flights on March 6th, 1995, to tape the Jenny Jones Show. During the taping, Donna and Scott are seated on stage first and presented to the audience first. Jenny's kind of egging on the audience. There is a short clip you can watch. There's little clips you can watch online, but this show never actually aired. So Jenny's kind of like, what's your fantasy, Scott? Do you have any fantasies about Jonathan? And you can tell Scott's a little, you know, timid. He looks a little nervous. He doesn't want to be answering, but Jenny pushes. And he says, you know, I do have a hammock in my backyard, and, you know, it would involve tying Jonathan up in a hammock. And then he just stops, and Jenny is like, and she keeps pushing him and pushing him. And Scott says, well, it would entail whipped cream and stuff like that. Now they're going to introduce Jonathan, and he walks out onto the stage. He immediately sees Scott and Donna. You can see him. He walks right up to Donna, hugs her, kisses her, and then he gives Scott this really awkward hug. And Jenny says to Jonathan, did you think that it was Donna that had the crush on you? And Jonathan says, no. He says, no, Donna and I are just really good friends. And that's when Jenny tells Jonathan that it's Scott that has the crush on him. Jonathan immediately looks at the two of them and says, "You lied to me." But he says it in a joking manner. He's laughing, he's smiling, and he does say, "Well, you know, it's flattering, but I am definitely heterosexual." After the show finishes its taping, the three of them actually hang out in Chicago that night, and they went to bars together, they went to dinner together. I also read that they actually asked Jonathan to switch his flight because the producers had him booked on a different flight, you know, just in case. And they switched his flight, so the three of them all flew back together, and Jonathan actually gave Scott and Donna a ride home. They even hung out at Scott's trailer for a little bit when they got back home, and then they went out to a bar that night. A few nights later, Jonathan arrives home from work to find a gift and a note at his door. The note says, "If you really want to get it off, I'm the only one who has the right tool." This note enrages Jonathan. I believe Jonathan had been out drinking with some co-workers before he arrived home to find this note, so he's just really unreasonably upset. And he gets in his car, he goes to the bank, he gets some money, he goes to separate hardware stores to buy a gun, he goes back home, assembles the gun, then he goes to Scott's house. He leaves the gun in the car. When he arrives at Scott's house, he goes to the front door and Scott invites him in. Scott also had another friend over that night. His name was Gary. And at this point, Scott admits to Jonathan that, yes, the note was from him. And Jonathan says, "You know what? I'm going to stay, but I got to go back out to my car because I left it running." So Jonathan leaves the trailer, goes back out to his car, comes back, knocks on the door again. And this time when Scott answers, Jonathan is standing there with a 12-gauge Buckeye shotgun pointed directly at Scott. Scott screams for his friend Gary to come help. He yells, "Help, Gary, Jonathan's got a gun." And at that point, Scott picks up a chair in self-defense. And when he picks up that chair, Jonathan shoots Scott twice in the chest. He flees from the home and he goes to a gas station and immediately calls 911. The first thing that Jonathan says to the 911 operator is, "I think I just shot a man." She asks him why, and he says, "Because he played a very bad thing on me. He took me on the Jenny Jones show." With Jonathan's confession, he is now arrested on one count of first-degree murder and a second count for felony possession of a firearm. Jonathan's trial begins on October 14th, 1996. He is going to be tried for first-degree premeditated murder, basically stating that he had time to make another choice during that night. And no matter what the Jenny Jones show did, what the defendant did was worse. The defense tries to prove that Jonathan was not in his right mind, and they blame everybody but Jonathan. Shooting, but no murder, is what Jonathan's lawyer is trying to push. He says that Jonathan suffers from depression, alcoholism, he has Graves' disease. And now, Graves' disease is an immune system disorder that results in the overproduction of thyroid hormones. So they're trying to say that this is one of the reasons that Scott was murdered, is because Jonathan is depressed with Graves' disease. They're saying that Jonathan has bipolar disorder and that this Jenny Jones ambush is what ignited his depression. And his lawyer says that he has major affective disorder and he has no control over his actions because of this disorder. Bipolar disorder is also known as bipolar affective disorder, and it's one of the top 10 leading causes of disability worldwide. Bipolar disorder is characterized by chronically occurring episodes of mania or hypomania, alternating with depression. Jonathan's defense team is going to use one of the most controversial defense mechanisms in a courtroom, and this is called the gay panic defense. According to the LGBTQ bar website, the panic defense is a legal strategy wherein defendants charged with violent crimes weaponize their victim's real or perceived sexual orientation or gender identity expression to reduce or evade criminal liability. It is not a freestanding defense to criminal liability. Rather, the defense is a legal tactic that bolsters other defenses, such as insanity, provocation, or self-defense. When a defendant uses the LGBTQ plus panic defense, they argue that their violent actions are both explained and excused by their victim's real or perceived sexual orientation or gender identity expression. The goal of this strategy is to employ homophobia and transphobia to persuade a jury into fully or partially acquitting the defendant. Whether or not this appeal to bigotry is successful in court, every time a defendant invokes the LGBTQ plus panic defense, they reinforce the dangerous and discredited belief that LGBTQ plus lives are worth less than others. Jonathan's defense team is trying to say that Scott's death was his own fault and that Jonathan was the actual victim. Jonathan was brought up in a family that did not approve of a homosexual lifestyle, and Jonathan's father took the stand in his defense to say that Jonathan was worried that everyone would think he is gay. His father says to the defense attorney, "I mean, how would you feel if your father thought you were gay?" That entire statement by Jonathan's father pisses me off so far beyond belief. The jury ends up finding Jonathan guilty of second-degree murder, and he's sentenced to 25 to 50 years in jail. On September 15th, 1998, this was overruled, and it was because Jonathan's defense team asked for a retrial because they claimed that they should have been allowed to remove a certain juror from the trial, but they were not allowed to. And it was not explained why they wanted this certain juror removed, but the judge agreed and granted Jonathan a retrial in 1999 for resentencing, and he could only be tried for second-degree murder. It just ended up becoming the same outcome. So it was one count of second-degree murder, found guilty again. So 25 to 50 years and 2 years for the firearm charge. And the big question ends up being, did Jenny Jones play a part in this murder? Hell yes, she did. This would not have happened. That episode, that whole ambush, that whole secret crush revealed, being on TV, not knowing what was going to happen, that was totally the catalyst for what that man did. Is Jenny Jones more to blame than Jonathan is? No, I don't believe so. But should Jenny Jones and the producers of her show, they could have taken a different approach to these. They didn't care about anyone's mental stability. They didn't care about anyone's feelings getting hurt. They were just trying to make good TV. So lawyer Jeffrey Feiger is going to now represent the family of Scott Amador. And what he's going to say is that the producers should have screened the guest and they should have also provided counseling for the guest. Jenny Jones producer Karen Campbell testified that when she called Jonathan and told him that he could be on the show, she told him it could be a man or a woman. Jenny also took the stand herself, and she didn't do herself any favors by doing that. She comes off to me as very cold. She is not accepting any responsibility whatsoever. She didn't think that the show did one thing wrong. On May 7th, 1999, the jury does find in favor of Scott Amador's family, and they award them $25 million in damages. However, the decision was then appealed by the Jenny Jones Show and its producers. On October 23rd, 2002, the Michigan Court of Appeals overturns the judgment, and they say that the murder of Scott Amador was unforeseeable and that the show had, quote, no duty to anticipate and prevent the act of murder committed by Jonathan Schmitz 3 days after leaving that studio, and they were hundreds of miles away at that point. Jenny Jones would say, that she believed Scott Amador's murder was a horrible tragedy, but I have always believed that it was fundamentally wrong and unfair to blame the show. Scott's family then tries to now appeal this overturned decision, and the Michigan Supreme Court and the Supreme Court of the United States both declined to hear the case. The aftermath of this happening resulted in a lot of talk shows at that time trying to implement psychological profiling when they were searching for their guest. So Jenny Jones never aired this episode. I did want to share with you something that I heard that Phil Donahue said. So when the trial was going on and they were getting sued by the family, Phil Donahue came out and said this. "This comes very close to saying that producers have a responsibility to administer a sanity test for all prospective guests." Yes, that is exactly what it's coming close to saying, and that is exactly what should have happened in the first place. And we see this later on, as I'm going to cover the Megan Wants a Millionaire murder also, because this was now something that goes into reality TV later in the early 2000s, is that these people that you are putting on these shows, they need to have a psychological profile done. We don't know how they're going to react on TV. You're putting some of these people in the same household together, and they're living together on these reality shows. So now it's going to stem from talk show TV into reality TV later on. But we'll talk about that another time. Jonathan Schmitz was released from prison on August 22, 2017, after being granted parole for good behavior. Jonathan keeps a very low profile, and all we really know is that he lives in Michigan with his family, and he is a free man. The Jenny Jones Show, in its final two seasons, had dropped in the ratings heavily. The Jenny Jones Show actually experienced a ratings drop of 21% from its previous season in its 12th season. Following its cancellation in 2003, The Jenny Jones Show was replaced with a short-lived talk show, The Sharon Osbourne Show. Prosecutor Donna Pendergrass stated that she always felt that there was more sympathy for Jonathan than there should have been, and I agree. Donna Pendergrass said, "It's one thing to blow somebody off, it's another to blow them away." Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Residue. I hope you enjoyed it, and if you did, it would be super cool if you could leave me a 5-star review. That would be awesome, and I would actually send you some stickers in the mail. I know you want stickers. Everybody likes stickers. Okay, so I would love to hear your opinion on this case. If you want to talk to me, find me on Instagram at Residue Podcast or Facebook at Residue, a True Crime Podcast, and we can chat. Also, don't forget to stay paranoid.